Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Most Friday afternoons, I'm in the school all by myself. Most, if not all, of the teachers take their grading home, half of the admins leave at lunch, and the kids rocket away at the first ding of the bell. Friday afternoons are when I like to do an extra fine job mopping, because I know the floors will stay shiny for a couple of days instead of being muddied up by 8 a.m. Last Friday, Principal Mira stopped me in the morning as I emptied the trash can between the bathrooms. She asked, "Reggie, could you hold off on mopping the foyer and cafeteria this afternoon? We don't want anybody slipping and falling during the time capsule ceremony, do we?" "Hold off until when?" I asked. "Oh, just until after..." Principal Mira trailed off, realizing she was inadvertently asking me to stay very late. I laughed, reassured her with a smile, and resumed tying off the trash bag. "Don't worry about it," I winked. "I don't mind staying tonight." She asked, "Will you at least take a break for the ceremony?" I told her I would. I had already been planning to, actually. It was my class who filled the time capsule and planted it, oh, what would that be, 500,000 years ago now? Ha. No, it was 50 years ago, 1974. We finished class on a Friday, much like last, and gathered in the brand new cafeteria with a few of our parents. The construction crew who built the school's new wing left one of the floor tiles out and bored a cylindrical hole in the exposed square. To commemorate the new cafeteria, Ms. Montfort, the principal back then, passed around a metal tube that we all put something in. I put a plastic Vietnam soldier like my daddy in it. With all the toys and trinkets collected, Ms. Montfort put the tube in the hole, and the caretaker at that time, Alan Ortega, screwed down a plaque that said Time Capsule 1974, to be opened in 2024. Ms. Montfort told us we would all be able to come back with our children, and maybe even grandchildren, to see the capsule opened one day. But, you know, most of those kids grew up and moved away to better places. I'm one of the few that remained, and I never got around to having any kids. "Well, good," Principal Mira said, smiling, drawing me back from this flash of a memory. She put a hand on the side of my shoulder, very professionally. She said, "Because we were all thinking you should open the capsule. A few of your former classmates will be up front too, but you're the only one who's still a crucial part of this school." "Sure," I agreed, smiling despite my inner wince. Mira had done it tactfully, maybe even accidentally. But regardless, she had still reminded me of how I'd never left, never gotten away. Fast forward a few hours and a few awkward reunions later, and I was standing in front of a crowd of young families, bored locals, and a photographer from the town paper. Flanked by classmates I had not spoken with in decades, I unscrewed the brass plaque in the floor and raised the time capsule for the first time since Alan Ortega covered it 50 years prior. Since it had been encased in concrete instead of dirt, the capsule looked almost exactly as it had the day it went in the ground. Time stole its shine, but a little rubbing brought it back. The only thing that looked different to me was its size. I remembered it being this big log of a thing, too heavy to hold without Ms. Monfort's assistance. With it in my hands that day, I realized most of the young parents in the room were carrying insulated water bottles that were bigger than the old tube. The photographer from the local newspaper snapped a photo of me looking down at the time capsule like a newborn baby. Maybe you've seen it. Because of how everything blew up afterwards, that picture seemed to grow legs and run. Principal Mira tipped her head up and rushed forward as if suddenly remembering she had only asked me to participate in the ceremony a few hours earlier and I couldn't possibly have some grand speech prepared. Her polished shoe squeaked on the floor as she pivoted in front of me to address the crowd. Children, parents, and community members, 50 years ago this school marked the completion of this new wing, including our beautiful cafeteria, by burying a time capsule full of things the students at that time thought would be worth remembering. A few of those students are here with us today. She paused to allow a brief applause. Many of you know one of those students especially well. I've asked him to be the one to open the capsule today. So, without further ado, Mr. Muller? That's me, Reggie Muller. I stepped forward and proceeded to embarrass myself in front of the small audience. 5 decades really has a way of binding things shut. I fought with the capsule's lid until I felt the tiniest flinch of submission. I dug in, worried the veins of my forearm might pop, but the lid gave out first. It finally twisted. The photographer's camera flashed. A few seated audience members exhaled in relief. I turned the lid, then overturned it. Apparently, it was only threaded a couple of times. The time capsule's contents spilled out past my hand. I dropped the lid to try to catch them. A flurry of yellowed notes and newspaper clippings fluttered around my fingers, along with a 4x6 class photo initialed by everyone, a trick playing card with a note written on it, a comic strip, my plastic army dad, and finally, a golden locket on a silver chain. The chain caught on my pinky, making the locket the only item I successfully caught. I stood, dumbfounded at my own clumsiness, with the locket doing a pendulum dance below my hand. The camera flashed again. Someone gasped, not in the audience, but behind me. The acute sound came from one of my former and, honestly, forgotten classmates. I turned. One of them, I think her name was Alice, looked absolutely stupid with surprise. I think I could have tossed that locket straight into her mouth. Principal Mira looked too nervous to do anything at all. Alice, or maybe it was Ashley, pointed at the locket then. She screamed, "That was Olive's!" Principal Mira took the locket from me and hid it in the palm of her hand. Out of the audience's view, she popped open the golden heart. In the cafeteria's eerie stillness, we all heard the latch click. The sound repeated in seemingly endless echoes, awakening buried memories. Principal Mira gasped. Alice, or Ashley, trepidatiously stole the locket from the principal's hand and shrieked. The photo inside depicted a smiling 10-year-old named Olive Jefferson with her mother. She disappeared back in 74. No one ever learned what happened to her. To this day, she is considered a missing person. Her parents still hold out hope she might walk through their front door someday. They still live in the same house, and I've heard Olive's bedroom is still exactly as it was the day she vanished. That breaks my heart the most. Not the bedroom specifically, but how Mr. and Mrs. Jefferson can't move on. Every day that ends is nothing but another day Olive didn't come back to them. Olive's case is somewhat famous around here. It's the sort of topic you hear old guys at the diner discussing in low voices, accusing their personal suspects. Olive's story is told to children who grow up here to keep them close to home and away from strangers. Everybody assumes somebody whisked through town and snatched her away since no body has been found. So that's the version told to all the kids. Now you might be wondering why Olive's locket being inside the time capsule caused so much consternation amongst those who knew her. Two individual facts made the appearance of the locket disturbing. First, Olive disappeared before we buried the time capsule. She was not present the day we all dropped our little keepsakes into the shiny tube. Second, Olive famously wore the locket all the time. She only took it off to sleep when her mother caught her wearing it and told her she could choke. That detail was included in all the missing child bulletins. Investigators told the public to keep an eye out for any lockets laying around, golden lockets with silver chains, and to call them if such an item should be found. So, 50 years later, that's exactly what Principal Mira did. The original team of investigators are all dead. The mystery of what happened to Olive outlived each and every one of them. Her case is open, but no one has done any active investigation in probably 30 years at least. Keep in mind, she went missing long before cell phones and everybody having a security camera on their doorbell. Back then, when somebody went missing and nobody saw what happened, the police had to rely somewhat on miracles. A new detective took the locket into evidence, and Olive's case became the talk of the town and local media again. Speculations circulated about who could have stashed the locket in the time capsule, knowing it would be hidden for 50 years. The most compelling accusation pointed to Alan Ortega, the old caretaker. Since he is also dead, people gave him suspicious glances vicariously through me. They would sneer and turn away, as if somehow Alan's guilt could have transferred to me when I took over his position. Alan didn't do anything to Olive. I knew for certain, although I couldn't tell anyone why. A lot of people might laugh at a guy who grows up to be the janitor at his own school, but I happily took the job because I thought Alan was such a cool guy. Alan was always nice to me, and I liked him a lot. I genuinely looked up to him and saw nothing shameful about his work. No, Alan didn't do anything bad to anyone, I promise. Rather than give the nosy nobodies around town any attention, I simply absorbed the sideways looks and went through my weekend as usual. Although, Olive would not leave my mind. Monday morning, I got to the school at 6 to unlock everything and turn on the lights. I also performed a quick mop of the cafeteria and foyer since I had been unable to do so on Friday. A miniature swarm of news crews and curious locals wouldn't let me through with my bucket. That morning, I had the strangest experience with a pair of footprints. When I finished mopping the cafeteria, I looked back at my work. Dawn's golden light gleamed off the wet tiles, sparkling where any thicker smears of water still lingered. However, a set of dry children's shoe prints somehow survived. Confused but never one to leave a job unfinished, I wheeled my bucket over and doused the first two prints in gray water. It smelled awful by then. At least, I thought the odor I detected was the water. I painted back and forth along the whole trail, but as I reached what I thought was the end, I looked back and saw the earliest prints had begun to reappear. I repeated the process, adding force behind the mop to scrub away any rubber residue that might be immortalizing the shoe prints. This time, I continued past where I had first seen the prints end, and I found more. Right, left, right, left. For each right, I discovered a left, and vice versa. Around tables, they led me. Each time I looked behind myself, more shoe prints awaited. The prince led me and my mop to the cafeteria door. I paused to rest, with my back against the door, waiting the way I used to wait for my old Polaroid pictures to develop. 5 feet away, they began to appear on the drying floor. Right, left, right, left. Then, just a few inches from my own feet. Two shoe prints dried next to one another, like the child had come to a stop right before me. I looked up, meeting the approximate height of a child with shoes that size, and felt a shudder run down my spine. Though I saw nothing but the next table in front of me, I felt an uncomfortable connection, like making eye contact with a stranger. No, that's not right. It felt like accidentally making eye contact with someone you have not seen for a long time. Someone you pretend probably doesn't recognize you. Around the cafeteria, the evaporating water took the footprints with it until there were only the two right in front of me left. Then those two vanished. Voices began to trickle into the hallways, echoing down toward the cafeteria. I hurried away, admittedly unsettled. I busied myself with dusting the trophy display cases in the foyer while the students arrived. A few of the cheerier ones said good morning to me, but most shuffled past without a word. One child, a girl, I thought, walked past while I had my back turned and was leaning in behind the glass. Even inside the case, I detected a sour stench as the girl passed by. It reminded me of a dead, bloated possum belly up on the side of the road. Having been around some weird kids, I immediately became suspicious that the little girl might have picked up a dead animal on her way in and stuffed it in her backpack or something. "Hold up," I said, turning as fast as I could. Not one child stood behind me, though. The little girl, I felt sure, had just walked past me. Nowhere to be found. Her stink still hung on the air, though, so potent that I worried if anyone did walk by, they would blame it on me. I grabbed a can of Febreze off my cart and sprayed until I no longer detected the rotten odor. In the break room, I performed a quick self-assessment of my mental state, checking in to see whether I had gone crazy over the weekend. Principal Mira came to pour herself some coffee and found me probably looking like a crazy person staring at the round table in the corner. "Morning, Reggie. How was your weekend?" She sounded cheery enough to pull me out of my spiraling thoughts. Just seeing her sobered me up quite a bit. Can't have the boss thinking you've lost it, can you? "Pretty normal, you know, besides thinking about..." I didn't need to complete the sentence. "How about yours?" Mira's eyebrows went up like, "You won't believe this," and she said, "Pretty weird, to be honest. Everything that happened on Friday put me in a funk. I knew about that olive girl when I moved here, but holding something that belonged to her like that? God, it just made it so real. You actually knew her, didn't you? Weren't you in her class?" I nodded but kept my jaw clenched, which I hoped would signal my desire to change the subject. The principal took the hint. "Well, if you don't mind me saying, you should get some coffee yourself. You look a little groggy." At this, I smiled. "Just Monday, ma'am." She returned the smile, then left. During one class period, I cleaned the bathrooms. As usual, I started with the boys' room. I always put my wet floor sign in the door so any kids who had too much grape juice with lunch wouldn't be surprised by my presence, but no one came in. When it was time to clean the girls' room, I knocked, then cracked the door and announced myself. When no one answered, I wheeled in my cart and put the sign in the door. I also positioned my cart so the bathroom door could not be opened from the outside. I was bent over the toilet in one stall, scrubbing blue bubbles around the bowl, when I heard the stall door next to me swing open, then shut. I even heard the lock slick into place. "Hold on," I stammered. I left my scrubbing brush in the toilet and hurried out of the stall, keeping my eyes trained at the floor. "Just a second, I'll give you some privacy," I said, loudly enough for anyone who happened to be in the hall to hear me. When I reached my cart, I tried to slip past it through the door, but the door wouldn't open more than 2 or 3 inches before running into the cart. How, I wondered, could even a child have fit through that gap? My rush to leave prevented me from dwelling too much on this question. I wiggled the cart out of the way and slipped through the door, then stood out in the hallway waiting for the child to complete her business and leave so I could finish mine. 5 full minutes passed without so much as a flush or running faucet. When the clock in the hallway told me it had been almost 10 minutes, I started to wonder if I should send someone in to check on the girl. Fortunately, one of the substitute teachers came down the hallway on her way to another classroom. I told her a student had been in the bathroom for a while and asked if she could just peek in real quick to make sure everything was all right. The sub dipped into the bathroom, then came back out looking confused and a little suspicious. "There's nobody in there?" she asked me, as if I knew this. I said, "No, I definitely heard." Heard. I didn't see anyone, just heard that stall door close and lock. I said, "Ah, you know, I must have been preoccupied when she came out. My bad."
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
The sub half smiled and said, "No worries. Good luck in there. Smells like a mouse died in the ceiling or something." I waited until she walked away, then ducked back into the bathroom and rammed my cart against the door. She was right. The stench of decay permeated the bathroom, a smell far too hideous to have come from some child who ate too much bean salad. Plus, I had to remind myself that I'd lied to the substitute. At no point had my attention been anywhere but on the bathroom door. I knew beyond any doubt no one had exited the bathroom. The stall door, I heard, was unlocked, but still mostly shut. I pushed it open and found what may have been at least partially responsible for the smell. It was in the toilet bowl. Blood. So much blood I could not see the bottom of the bowl. I gagged and pulled my shirt over my mouth and nose. Wasn't it possible a girl had her, you know, and just left it? No, the elementary students were too young for that, weren't they? I guess I had heard on the news girls were getting their periods younger and younger. Either way, I flushed the blood. More poured from the rim holes in a crimson torrent. I hastily lifted the top of the tank to see if someone, as a horrific prank, had put something dead in there. At this point, the fill valve began spraying red water into the otherwise empty tank. I ran to a sink and turned the faucet on. I whistled my relief as clear water gushed into the sink. I returned my attention to the toilet, but it too was full of clear water now. The blood disappeared from the bowl and tank, leaving no trace. For good measure, I flushed again, then scrubbed the toilet. The smell lingered, but I Febrezed it away. Throughout the day, I felt tugs at my clothes as I walked through the hallways, but each time I turned to look, nobody was there. I chalked it up to the recently unearthed memory of my friend Olive. Her locket turning up at the same time all this weirdness started was just the sort of coincidence that could make people believe in ghosts, I thought. I did not, by any stretch, believe in ghosts. Yet. I thought the subtle tugs at my clothes were merely psychosomatic symptoms of something akin to guilt. I've certainly felt guilty about Olive's disappearance over the years. Whenever I've thought of her, I've wondered why it hadn't been me who disappeared. At the end of the day, I decided to give the cafeteria another mopping. The students were all outside lining up for the buses, and their teachers were doing their best to corral them. I essentially had the school to myself. I took my bucket over to where those unerasable footprints had stopped. I bobbed the mop up and down like its head was really the head of someone I wanted to drown, but paused before sloshing any water onto the floor. I heard a dull impact like the thud of a rubber mallet. It came from somewhere up ahead. It could easily have been an air duct or pipe making the sorts of noises those things do, but everything that happened prior made me curious. The thud repeated, giving me a more specific direction to look. It came from the far side of the cafeteria, all the way across from where I stood then. I leaned the mop handle on a table and walked toward the noise. The next time it occurred, a metallic slithering accompanied it. This added sound was much louder than the original noise and froze me. From there, I saw the source of at least the second sound. The brass plaque, which had been placed over the time capsule and then reset for safety until a new plaque could be created for the next capsule planting, rested on the floor next to the square space it was meant to occupy. Someone had moved it, slid it away from the time capsule's hole. I assumed a child, some curious student, had moved the plate away to look at where the time capsule had been. I didn't bother to screw it back down after everything that happened after the ceremony. Maybe the child was curious whether the capsule had been put back after being emptied, or perhaps they wanted to know if any more trinkets would magically appear. But what I saw next caused me to quickly abandon this theory, along with many of my previously held beliefs. Because what I saw next defied reality. Four skeletal fingertips trembled upward from the cylindrical hole. All light seemed to fade from the room until the thumb bone appeared in a hazy spotlight. The edges of my vision blurred like I might black out at any second. A skeleton hand planted itself, palm down on the tile. The only pieces of tissue attached to it were ligaments holding the tiny bones together. The hand had most certainly belonged to a child. A little girl, I felt certain. A little girl named Olive. From beneath the bony palm, smoke began to churn, then rise. I blinked against the black cloud as it stole what remained of my vision. A series of burning pops echoed off the floor. I thought of the smoke detectors, the sprinklers. The school's safety system automatically sent an alert to the emergency dispatchers if either of those devices got triggered. I had no desire for that kind of attention, given the circumstances. Wouldn't that be just perfect? Another reportedly crazy janitor for the town to gossip about. Choking and blinking, I stumbled back to my bucket. I turned it over, spilling water across the entire cafeteria. When it sizzled, I knew it had reached the scorching skeleton. Was there more down there? More than just a hand? Was Olive's skull down there, grinning permanently with her tiny teeth, the front two missing as they had been on the day she vanished? I heard the water pouring into the hole, drowning her. The smoke began to clear, thankfully, before any alarms went off. Seeing no hand extruding from the hole anymore, I sloshed toward it. Light returned to the room. My vision remained hazy, and I figured it would be that way for a while, but I could see well enough. The tile the bone had touched appeared to be the only one affected by the burning. I kicked at the murky water, swirling black char with my shoe. Using the mop, I cleared enough water away to see the bony hand had scorched letters into the tile's top layer. They were crude, barely recognizable from the English alphabet. They looked like they had been written by a child who had not quite grown into her pencil yet. The letters, once I deciphered them, read, "Take my place." I hurried out of the building, leaving my overturned mop bucket behind. I needed to get away from those words burned into the floor. I left the school through one of the back doors and walked until I reached the old playground, the tall wooden one the teachers don't let kids play on anymore. A new neon-colored metal playground stands in front of the school now. The wooden one, the old one behind the school, is the one I used to play on when I was a kid. It's the one I used to play on with Olive. I had to get away from the words burned into the cafeteria floor, not because they were written by a ghost, but because they were an answer to a prayer I've been saying for 50 years. It goes like this. Olive, sweet, sweet Olive, what can I ever do to make it right? I've prayed this thousands of times because it usually supplies just a few seconds of relief from the torment of guilt. I killed Olive Jefferson. I finally admit it. It's not the weight off my shoulders I hoped it would be, but that relief is on its way. When Olive and I were kids, we lived across the street from each other. The school was just down the road. We met up almost every evening after supper and walked down to play on the old wooden playground. Sometimes our classmates would be there, but usually it was just the two of us. One day, I climbed on top of the monkey bars. Just on a whim, I ran across them. It was a risky exercise. Those bars were probably 10 feet above the wood chips below. I'm not exaggerating. I'm looking at the ladder that once led up to them right now. Kids today will never understand how dangerous and fun playgrounds were back then. Olive scolded me for doing something so dangerous, and I, just wanting to impress her, repeated the action, going back. I accused her of being jealous, mad that I could do something she was afraid to try. Olive, sweet but oh so competitive, took me up on my challenge. She climbed the ladder, wriggled herself up on top of the bars, then slowly stood. I don't think I've ever seen anyone stand up so slowly, so uncertainly. I could see her nervousness right away, but I didn't say anything. I didn't let her out of the dare. I could have agreed about how dangerous and stupid it was. I didn't know what could happen. I didn't know how bad it could be. Halfway across, Olive missed a bar, and her leg almost went all the way through. I stepped out and tried to catch her. When I grabbed her dress, she overbalanced and tipped the other way. I've wondered every day if I had held on, if she would have lived, but I did not. Fearing she would take me down with her, I let go. I watched her fall backward off the monkey bars. On her way down, the back of her skull connected with one of the wooden steps. I heard it crack. Her open eyes rolled back in her head. She started spasming in the wood chips. I climbed down to her, knowing I should yell for help, but too afraid to do so. By the time I reached her, her movements ceased. I knew what that meant. I was scared. I thought I would spend the rest of my life in prison, locked up for murder. I dragged Olive's body toward the back of the school before anyone could see us from the street. There, I thought. I thought about just leaving Olive for someone else to find. I could not see how they could connect the crime to me, except our parents and many of our friends knew we liked to hang out on that playground. To me, back then, that was damning enough evidence. I decided no one could find Olive, at least not for a long time. The school happened to be constructing a new wing at that time, which would include the current cafeteria. They had not yet finished the floor, They had barely begun to build it. I buried Olive there, hoping she would be covered up for good and hidden beneath the school's new wing. And for 50 years, this plan worked. I know you may be thinking I must have placed that locket in the time capsule. I must have kept it until my position gave me the opportunity to stash it. But no, I buried Olive with the locket around her neck. How it got into the time capsule is just as much a mystery to me as anyone. Did I ever think of going to the police later on? Maybe once the case turned 20, 30, 40 years old? Of course I did. This idea occurred to me far more than on the case's milestone anniversaries. But I'm a coward. I've always been afraid of the legal consequences, not of killing Olive, but of hiding her fate for so long. The more time passed, the more untenable that option seemed. But now my life faces a new threat. Olive has emerged from beneath the cafeteria. I believe today's haunting was only the beginning of the torment she could deal to me. But she's told me the way out, an answer to my prayer. Take my place. I hear her coming. I hear her small footsteps in the wood chips. I'm sitting on the step which terminated her final thought. I will not run. I will be brave just this once so that I never have to be brave or afraid again. This is my confession, and now I must face my sentence. Olive Jefferson, take my place. You made it out. Congratulations. If you enjoyed the story, please rate and review this podcast wherever you like to listen. Reviews are the best way to support the podcast and help it grow. The next best way is to buy merch from thewarningwoods.myshopify.com. The link is also in the description below. If you want more creepy content, follow me on Instagram at thewarningwoods. If you feel ready, meet me here next week for another journey into the Warning Woods. Thank you for listening.
Greetings, adventurers. Today we're excited to introduce you to a new story, Dark Dice, a horror podcast that blurs the line between actual play and audio drama, where the story is determined by the roll of the dice. Six adventurers embark on a journey into the ruinous domain of the Nameless God. They will never be the same again. One of the players is not what they seem after a doppelganger, a creature that can assume the form and voice of whatever it kills, infiltrates the team. As the players are picked off and replaced one at a time, can they figure out who the monster is before it's too late? Can you? Here's a quick example of what our show sounds like.
The shambler with the jar of liquid inside of him.
Soren Arkwright let loose an arrow that cracked the glass, passing through the spine of the creature. The shambler still managed to maintain its forward momentum, but stumbled as it eagerly tried to bite and swipe at Soren, landing near his feet.
As Jeff Goldblum has now joined our cast, Dark Dice is available however you listen to podcasts.